The Devil in Disguise is sort of the topic of Nick Redfern's new book, Final Events. I'll read you an excerpt from it. It sort of sets the stage for what this book covers. It says, the conclusion of this group, called the Collins Elite, is that we have in our midst a cold-hearted and sinister intelligence of demonic origins that masquerades as alien, whose presence in our world threatens each and every one of us, and that consigns all of us to, perhaps quite literally, a living hell. Scary stuff. You know, we've talked about aliens and UFOs on this program for as long as any of us can remember, whether they're ETs, EBEs, time travelers, whether they're us in some other guise, interdimensionals. This is a different take on the subject. When we come back, Nick Redfern explains his premise and the evidence he has to support it. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. When I say that Nick Redfern is a prolific author, I'm not kidding. I'm sitting here looking at a list of the books that he's written, and probably several of these are ones that you're familiar with topics and titles such as Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, On the Trail of the Saucer Spies, Body Snatchers in the Desert. But I have a feeling Nick never realized that he'd be traveling down this particular road, the one he covers in his new book, Final Events, and the Secret Government Group on Demonic UFOs and the Afterlife. Nick, am I right about that? Did you know you'd spend 4 years traveling down this particular rabbit hole?
Hey, George. I guess not, no. You know, this isn't an area I've sort of delved into before, this particular angle. Now, there have been in the past several books written on the whole issue of, you know, do UFOs have occult or demonic origins? But the idea of actually digging into the whole story from a governmental perspective, you're quite right. It isn't something, you know, I never really anticipated getting into at all.
Were you reluctant to go this way? You know, I see you at occasional UFO conferences. Yeah. You're always so erudite and careful about your research and everything. And it would seem to me that if you were to tell your colleagues, hey, I'm researching whether UFOs are demonic, that you'd get a lot of guff.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's one of these things where it's very a highly controversial area because you're dealing essentially with belief systems, you know, that I think with the UFO subject, there's, like you pointed out at the beginning of the show, there's so many different theories, time travelers, interdimensional aliens, you name it. And I think that's because we don't possess the hard answers. So unfortunately, even though it's not always the best thing to do, inevitably belief systems creep in and we become biased towards this idea or that idea. So what I tried to do with this book, because it is such an emotive and controversial topic, was leave my views out and just focus on the history of how and why certain people and groups within the government appear to have gone down this path and embraced it and supported it. So, you know, rather than me saying every second paragraph, well, I agree with this or I disagree with that, you know, just tell it as if I was writing a history, a book about the history of the CIA or the FBI, you know, just a straightforward accounting of what happened and why.
Right. Well, you know, I remember a news account, Dan Rather reporting on the Voronezh incident in Russia, where, you know, he tells about what the witnesses saw out there, these 10-foot-tall pinhead aliens, scoffing almost like, well, gosh, we know what aliens look like. That's not what they look like, as if any of us really does know what an alien looks like or knows where an alien comes from. The fact that we would vehemently support the idea it must be extraterrestrial rather than demonic, the fact is we don't know, do we?
No, we don't know. I mean, I think the best we can say for certain is that there is some sort of UFO intelligence that interacts with us deeply on occasions and intimately, but equally plays as like a silent partner as well, in the sense it doesn't do the classic thing of landing on the White House lawn. It doesn't cure cancer. It doesn't save the rainforest, but it seems to have some sort of intimate relationship with us as well. And there's no doubt in my mind that it's a real phenomenon that's nothing to do with us. But that, again, you have that big question of how we define what it is or what it isn't. And of course, you know, a lot of it does come down to belief. You know, John Smith believes it's this. Bill Jones believes it's that. David Smith believes it's something else. You know, and I think that, as I said, that's inevitable. That is going to happen. But it doesn't take away, regardless of the actual belief systems, it doesn't take away from the fact that something's going on and interacting with us.
Well, let's start with how you got chasing this particular branch of the mystery. It starts with a visit to Nebraska to meet somebody on a cold winter day. Tell me who that was.
Yeah, well, this is a man named Ray Beauchesne. Ray isn't, I guess, a name that perhaps people who've been involved in the UFO subject in, say, the last 5 or 10 years might instantly be aware of. But Ray is an Anglican priest who used to be a state director for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. And Ray ran the Nebraskan chapter of MUFON for a number of years. And he had a lot of involvement in the UFO subject. One of the main things he did, particularly in the 1980s, was to lobby his senator to try and see if there are any American military and intelligence files on the famous UFO landing at Rendlesham Forest in England in 1980. So in other words, you know, he's someone who's been at the forefront of a lot of intriguing investigations. And what happened was that in late 1991, so we're talking now nearly 20 years ago, Ray was contacted by two Department of Defense physicists who asked if they could have a face-to-face meeting with him. Now, of course, it's not every day you get a phone call from two Department of Defense physicists saying, you know, can we meet? We have something urgent to discuss with you on the UFO topic, no less. And, of course, Ray, you know, having an interest in the subject and being a MUFON state director, said certainly. And a meeting was arranged in November 1991 at a particular hotel in Lincoln, Nebraska, where Ray lives to this day. And essentially what it was, the two guys basically sat down, I guess in almost like a classic whistleblower scenario, echoes of Deep Throat from All the President's Men, that sort of situation. And they wanted to tell Ray about a project they were working on, but also to get his opinion on what he felt about it. And essentially, this project they described to Ray was designed to contact what the physicists called non-human entities, or NHEs. You know, you mentioned earlier about EBEs, standing for extraterrestrial biological entities. They never alluded to the idea that these were alien or anything else, just that they were non-human entities. And this appears to have been some sort of very clandestine project deeply buried within the intelligence/defense community. And the whole idea of the project was to try and contact these non-human entities and try and understand and harness the what seemed to be the extraordinary mind powers that they possess. And one of the things the project was thinking about, you know, for example, if you look at alien abductions, often people report being rendered into an altered state and essentially, you know, we're at their mercy. And the idea of the military was, well, if we can understand and harness these powers that these entities possess, maybe we could use it as a weapon. You know, that's what how the military thinks. And the idea was trying to train people, just regular people, like military people, in a similar fashion to the whole remote viewing program, try to train them to exploit or use the powers of these entities to, I guess, cause psychic assassinations in simple terms, like causing heart attacks and strokes at a distance where, you know, you don't have a typical lone gunman scenario. You know, you actually do it remotely and no one would ever know it was an assassination. They just think it was a tragic, untimely death.
Well, we do know, in fact, that that kind of research has been done by our government and other governments, yeah. So it sort of fits with that.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that at all. And what Ray was shown were a number of sort of disturbing photographs that he described to me when I did a personal interview with him. He described seeing these photographs that the guys brought along with them of three people sitting in what he described as like dentist chairs who essentially had been killed in these experiments, reportedly. One of the photographs showed one of these people with the skull kind of crushed. Another one had a fatal heart attack. And the third one, Ray wasn't sure how the person had died, but the inference was that they'd been involved in these experiments to contact what we would call the greys, but they call non-human entities. And the most disturbing thing that the guy said to Ray was that as the project went on, it was sort of like a black cloud descended over it, where there was this sort of air of negativity around them all the time. You know, they would go to work, go into the lab or the offices, and it was just, you could almost feel the air saturated with negativity was how they described it. And they came to believe that while the greys, that these non-human entities were very real, they believed that initially, in good faith, they thought they were trying to contact alien entities. But as time went on, they felt that the so-called greys are deceptive creatures, which quite literally are demonic entities masquerading as aliens, I guess, to get their grips into the human race and sort of lull us over to the dark side if one day there's sort of some massive landing, if you like, or showing of themselves. Now, you know, as I point out, this is the theory of these guys and this larger think tank. It's, you know, it's not Nick Redfern hammering home this point that this is definitely the truth. You know, I've tried, as I said, I've tried to leave my views out and point out that this is a conclusion reached by this particular think tank, representatives of whom Ray met and who I met several as well. And we're putting between us, you know, we're putting the story out there and just trying to see which avenue it goes down. Is it real? Is it disinformation? Are their views real, but have they got the point of origin wrong? You know, it's, as some people have rightly said, it's very easy for somebody to conclude something's demonic from hell, but it might just as easily be interdimensional from some very strange realm. You know,
that, or all of the above. I mean,
all of the above. Yeah, it's a difficult story to, you know, unravel in that respect.
I don't know Ray Beauchesne, so I don't know about his credibility. But of course, it's a natural question to ask. You say that in 1991, he was visited by these two guys from the Defense Department, who told him this incredible story. Who said that they were trying to unlock this, these mysteries. Asked him for his advice and input. Do you believe him? I mean, what else do you have to support the idea that these two guys really did come to see him?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a good question, you know, and as I know from your perspective as an investigative researcher, those are the sort of vital questions we ask, you know. And I mean, Ray actually told this story long before he told it to me, and he's been consistent with it throughout the years. The story was told very, very briefly in one of Linda Howe's books, Glimpses of Other Reality, published in 1994, and also there were a couple of pages devoted to it in Jenny Randall's 1999 book, Friend or Foe, about the Rendlesham Forest case, because Ray had involvement. And he's been consistent with the story, you know, never wavered in all the people he's spoken to about it. The main reason why the story isn't that known is because nobody's really followed it to this extent before or published, you know, the extensive, intricate details of the whole meeting that he had. But as I said, Ray's a, you know, he's a practicing Anglican priest, a former state director of MUFON, and, you know, someone who, as I said, has stuck to the story over the years and has nothing to gain from it, you know, from relating this story.
And, well, the obvious question, why'd they pick him?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Ray admitted that it's speculation on his part, but he felt that these guys wanted his opinion as to whether or not the project should continue. You know, if they continue with the project, would it go down an even darker path? Was it possible to, you know, close doorways or portals that might have been opened and, you know, that we're now letting these entities in? And because Ray had a background in religion, you know, as an Anglican priest, and with MUFON, you know, there aren't many people in the UFO field who work, you know, as a priest, but equally have a deep background and are working no less as a state director for MUFON. And
that's
true. He felt that there was something, it had to be something along those lines, that they were looking for someone who'd had involvement in both areas, who could comment on their beliefs and ideas that this was a negative phenomenon, and who could also possibly give some insight into whether or not, or how, you know, the general public could be told, if they should be told, and whether or not these people should stop dabbling in this and move away from it. So I think it was partly to get his advice and opinions and also, you know, the concerns about what would happen if they continued doing the research.
Well, let's explore that for a second, because it sort of becomes an underlying theme in the book, is that the possibility that these agents and this agency that was investigating this stuff had somehow tried to establish communication, had opened some sort of a door, a portal, a window, and that things came in and that shouldn't have come in. Why don't you talk about that in an overall sense, and then we'll get into some specifics.
Yeah, sure. This was basically the idea that, you know, rather than sort of nuts and bolts spacecraft landing, as we said, on the White House lawn, the idea was that people, literally within the Defense Department, were sort of consulting ancient texts and books on demonology and using archaic rites and rituals to quite literally summon up these entities that, you know, the UFO research community calls the Greys. You know, they weren't trying to contact them by radio or whatever, you know, radio waves or anything like that. It was literally, you know, invoking and using ancient rites and rituals. And the story was, you know, that they didn't necessarily come through in nuts and bolts craft. The group actually came to believe over time that, you know, this was more of like a hologram type thing, that these weren't sort of flesh and blood entities. They were almost like a demonic intelligence, if you like, that in some cases weren't even sort of, you know, had physical form, although they could manifest physically in some respects, that the group believed. So in other words, the idea was that this portal was opened. Now, by portal, you know, in simplistic terms, we're talking about a gateway to another realm that some people would quite possibly correctly, you know, would suggest was like another dimension. But the group concluded it was literally like a doorway or portal to hell, and allowed these entities to come through in like a deceptive mode of extraterrestrials. And then it was a case of, well, you know, we can actually learn quite a bit if we can harness their powers, but should we try it? Can we actually take on the forces of hell in some sort of Faustian pact? That was literally the way it was looked at. But again, you know, based on belief systems, one man's alien is another man's demon. You know, that's the sort of the basic background as to how and why they were looking at this. It was a case of trying to contact these entities, open doorways, and then try and militarize any powers or skills that might be developed from liaising with these entities.
Which is exactly what our government would do, isn't it? I mean, that's exactly what you would expect them to do if they were confronted with something that seemed to have so much kind of power.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, you made the good point earlier about how the government had researched, you know, ESP and things like this. I mean, you know, the whole remote viewing program in the 70s and 80s, that wasn't done just for the benefit of trying to understand the complexities of the human mind. It was done to try and spy on the enemy, you know. So, in other words, I think it's understandable that military agencies, intelligence agencies, are always on the lookout for new and novel ways to, you know, weaponize different phenomena. And whether it's intelligence and espionage gathering, or it's, you know, finding ways to literally remotely kill people from a distance, it's all part and parcel. Package of the same thing, if you like.
Now, Ray, your friend Ray, Anglican priest that he is, said that there is some sort of a focus on Christianity as opposed to other kinds of religion from whoever these entities are. Why don't you go explain that to us?
Yeah, well, I mean, Ray's done a lot of research into this area, and certainly, you know, this is one of the things that why there was so much research done for the book, you know, it covered 4 years, because I'll be the first to admit, you know, I'm not a particularly religious person. You know, I don't have any problem with what people believe at a religious level. But, you know, not being someone who sort of has that background, it required a lot of research. And so, you know, that's why the interviews were quite extensive for the book. And Ray basically has done a lot of research and found a number of cases where these sort of so-called alien entities, whatever they are, had made denials about Christianity when they were speaking to, you know, various abductees, contactees, whoever, and claiming, you know, that Christianity isn't really the truth behind what's going on. And what Ray found was that in a number of cases, it was always Christianity that was targeted rather than any other religions. It was always that one that was being criticized. And Ray kind of perceived it as being the, you know, the, as he saw it, sort of the two true forces, good and evil, you know, the Christian belief system and, you know, the minions of Satan squaring up against each other. And he felt that the denial of Christianity by these entities was evidence that they're probably not extraterrestrial, because they were focusing on just one religion.
Okay, we're getting into the good stuff now with Nick Redfern, talking about a secret government group that was studying demons disguised as ETs. We'll come back with more of this discussion right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Nirvana, masters of dark messages themselves, they might enjoy Nick Redfern's new book, Final Events. In this passage, he writes, something that very quickly led me into a rabbit hole-like maze populated by shadowy informants, scared old men in possession of horrifying decades-old secrets, and illuminating yet bizarre classified documentation. The long and winding story I've uncovered is both unsettling and unnerving in equal awful measures. And what it leads, Nick, to is a group called the Collins Elite. You've heard of MJ-12. This is sort of a version of MJ-12, but studying something very, very strange. When we come back, we'll find out who the Collins Elite is and what they were up to on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest Nick Redfern told us about a conversation he had with a friend of his, Ray Beauchet, who introduced the idea that he'd been visited by these two fellows from a government agency. And as Nick was to learn, these guys work for something called the Collins Elite. Nick, how did you get on the trail of the Collins Elite? How did you find out that it even existed?
Yeah, this is sort of a long and winded story, I guess, George. What happened?
That's okay. That's all right. We have time.
I guess we do. Well, basically, you know, sometimes when you're investigating UFO stories, as they particularly relate to government involvement and official secrecy, you know, you get so far and you just hit a stumbling block. You know, it's how do we take this to the next level? You know, it's kind of like Roswell. You know, it's we know something happened and the government lied about it, basically. But it's if the files exist, how do we get them? You know, that's the stumbling block we face with that case. And, you know, sometimes you get more and sometimes you get less data depending on circumstances. And when Ray related this account to me in its full entirety, which had never been really published in all its sort of intricacies before, I thought, wow, you know, these guys, although it was just sort of several meetings, several in-person meetings and then follow-up phone calls and communications, et cetera, they related a tremendous amount of material suggesting the project had been going on for a long time, because Ray's meeting was practically 20 years ago, even today. And, of course, covering a lot of different areas like opening portals, consulting ancient texts, etc. It was quite clear to me that if this was real and it wasn't disinformation to deceive Ray, that, you know, that a lot of work had gone into this project. And if that's the case, then surely there must have been meetings and discussions and a realization that, you know, the project was put, how it was put together, why it was put together, there must have been funding. So this sort of made me think, you know, whether it was true or not, the logic would dictate that some sort of agency or body, if you like, had to have been put together at some point. And so I said to Ray, you know, well, this is a really interesting story, but how do we get beyond just this one piece of the story? You know, I said, you know, you've convinced me that you met these guys and the story's valid. Is there a way to take it further? And Ray was, well, not from me there isn't. You know, I've related to you basically the entire story as it happened, this sort of deep throat whistleblower type encounters he had with these guys from the Department of Defense. And so what I did, I thought, well, you know, I actually spent a few months just kind of trying to figure out how to get further. I just could not take it further. Now, I spoke to a couple of people who shared the views, but, you know, these were just people in the UFO research community. There were a couple of books previously written on this particular issue of demonic UFOs, but, you know, this not from the government perspective. Now, what Ray, there were several things when I interviewed Ray that he asked me not to publish in the book, and I agreed not to do that. And this related to his speculation as to how the guys had managed to track him down, and certain players and certain Air Force bases that were possibly involved and that may have sort of led him to be brought into the picture. And so basically what I did, I just laid my cards on the table and without naming Ray by name, phoned up the relevant agencies and Air Force bases and offices specifically where there was speculation of them having had involvement in making the connections with Ray, and said, look, you know, I've heard this story, I'm researching it, I work as an author, you know, I'm not going to lie to you, and I'm interested in speaking to someone who may have some information on this meeting or this particular story in general. And I basically got a reply of, well, that's very interesting, sir, but it's nothing that the military gets involved in, you know, it's good luck with a book. It was literally along those lines.
Sure.
And then, you know, I was like, well, I'm not going to be able to take it any further unless, you know, I start advertising in magazines. And then, of course, if you put the core story out there, you don't know if somebody contacts you is the real thing or they're just some fantasist who's picking up on what you've said and then parroting back, you know, in their own fantasy, if you like. But what happened was I got a very strange series of phone calls, almost like enigmatic, which barely ever happens. You know, I think everybody at some point in their ufological career either meets or speaks with whistleblower-type characters or has, you know, sort of a strange, enigmatic relationship with people in the official world. And that's what happened. I essentially got a call from Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. Now, that was weird in itself because the number actually showed up on my phone. There was no attempt to block the number. And, you know, sometimes military organizations are quite antsy about, you know, numbers popping up if they phone someone for security reasons. And I was actually, I Googled the number and I was able to prove that it did come from Offutt Air Force Base. And the office it came from was like an operator service that was responsible for channeling internal calls outside of the base. So it didn't give me the internal number, unfortunately, but I was able to verify that it was an operator service at Offutt and got to speak to someone who said, well, we understand you're following this story. Would you might like to meet someone from the Collins Elite? And I was like, well, what's a Collins Elite? You know, it didn't mean anything to me in the slightest at all. And essentially, it was just a case then of a few enigmatic words of, well, you know, this is a project or investigation you're following. Now, a number of people have quite rightly said, you know, and this raised the red flags with me. Why, if this is a classified project, why open it up to a UFO researcher who has already admitted in a previous call to thinking about writing a book on it? And, you know, I recognize, you know, that does put the red flags up. Are you being about to be swamped with disinformation to take you down one path when, you know, the other path is the valid one? But again, I think it comes down to something Ray once told me, and that was, it seems to be the case that the guys he interviewed wanted him to put the story out there to see how the public might react to it. And Ray didn't, other than just mentioning it in a couple of lectures and it getting a brief mention in a few books, you know, just a couple of pages. And I think reading between the lines, there are people within government who believe this theory and want to put it out, but in a fashion that's, I guess, kind of in drips and drabs to see how people respond. And I suspect,
yeah, like run it up the flagpole and see if people freak out about it.
Yeah, and I think that's what's going on here, and that may have had something to do with at least me having the ability to speak to four or five people on the record or off the record, and several who I also interviewed who didn't even want to be quoted at all on or off the record in the book. But what happened was that I got a call, and I literally drove. I live in Dallas, Texas, and had to drive to Albuquerque to meet a man named Richard Duke, a very elderly but very sprightly guy, literally in his 80s, who was claimed to be one of the original members of the group. Now, of course, you know, sort of a million thoughts go through your mind. Again, you know, everybody at some point in ufology, not often, granted, but goes through this sort of scenario. And, you know, I was thinking, well, is it a setup? Is it just, I didn't believe it was a joke. I didn't think it was a hoax because, as I said, I've been able to trace the call back to the Air Force base. But I did wonder and sort of muse on the possibility if it was, you know, just to, I guess,
gamesmanship.
Yes.
Gamesmanship of some sort.
Yeah, sort of confuse the whole UFO issue even further by putting another theory out there to, you know, burying something else. So I went along with no sort of particular, I guess, agenda in mind, but just to listen to what this Mr. Duke had to say. And he essentially related the story of the beginnings of the group up until when he said he left in 1960. And, you know, people have said, well, could he have been trying to disinform you? And, you know, I don't mean this as any disrespect to people in their 80s, but he told such an intricate story that if say, 3 months earlier, he'd been briefed to say, hey, you know, we want you to spread disinformation to this guy, and here's the story. You know, for a guy in his mid-80s to, in that short period of time, learn this whole thing and then relate it to me, I think that would be a hard job for somebody in their 20s or 30s, never mind somebody, you know, in their mid-80s. And, you know, when he was sat opposite me, he did come across like someone speaking from memory, not someone who had been quickly prepped to learn a whole scenario, you know, in the last few days.
Right, and you're a journalist. You've been at this a long time. You interview the guy. You're asking him questions. It's not like you're inexperienced in pursuing this kind of stuff yourself.
No, that's right. I think, you know, with your perspective as well as an investigative journalist, when you sit opposite people enough times and listen to them, you know, you get to, you don't just listen to the story. You look at their mannerisms and reactions. You know, there are certain sort of characteristics, I think, at times where you can tell if someone's exaggerating or outright lying, or if somebody's honestly trying to recall something from memory. And he came across to me in the latter category as someone who had been involved a long, long time ago and who had a lot of memories that he was willing to share.
Tell us about, what did you learn about the Collins elite? I mean, Collins is not a person. Collins is a place, right?
Yeah, that's right. Basically, the story goes back to actually 1918. Now, that isn't when the Collins elite was set up, but 1918 was when one of the most infamous occultists, a man named Aleister Crowley, I'm sure a name that's familiar to pretty much everybody who listens to the show.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Crowley is known today and certainly as throughout his life as the Great Beast. You know, he was involved in numerous aspects of occult work, etc. And in 1918, he engaged in this strange ritual called the Amalantra Working, which essentially was a case of like entering an altered state via the ingestion of hashish and mescaline. And he engaged in this ritual, again, following ancient teachings, etc., and reportedly made contact with this interdimensional entity known as Lam, L-A-M. Now, if you look at Crowley's own drawing of Lam, which I've reproduced in the book.
On page 14, yep.
Yeah, it actually looks very alien grey-like. The only thing that's missing is sort of the dark black eyes, but instead you have these sort of penetrating, almost cat-like eyes, but you have sort of the little thin body and the huge bald head. Now, at the time, of course, Crowley wasn't saying these were EBEs from Zeta Reticuli or whatever. He interpreted it, again, that he'd opened a portal and due to his altered state of mind, that is the ideal way, he believed, to contact these entities, you know, that they inhabit some sort of realm where mind-to-mind contact, if you like, or in an out-of-body state is possibly their regular form of existence.
So he called this guy Lam, the creature Lam, but he said it was an Enochian entity?
Yeah, basically, it's talking, when you look at his story, you know, the important thing to remember that this is practically 30 years before the whole flying saucer thing kicked off in 1947 with Kenneth Arnold. So in other words, you know, the people weren't at this particular time talking about aliens, only the fact that, you know, it was possible to contact entities. But basically, an Enochian entity, it sort of takes its name from something called the Enochian call, which was a Kabbalistic language which was created in the 17th century by an Elizabethan magician named Dr. John Dee. And so again, you know, Crowley was actually taking the lead from people who'd been involved in similar things back in the 1600s. And what's interesting about Dr. John Dee is that he and a friend of his, Edward Kelly, they tried to undertake these sort of rites and rituals as well, and reportedly had made contact with, quote, little men who supposedly moved around in a little fiery cloud. That's the literal terminology that was used. So in other words, that sounds like a sort of proto-UFO encounter as well. Now, Crowley had a disciple and a follower who actually became, in many respects, even more renowned than Crowley, and that was a man named Jack Parsons. And Jack Parsons was one of the earliest and certainly the most brilliant rocket scientists in the 1930s. And his company that he formed, Aerojet, even to this day, they make the solid rocket boosters for NASA's Space Shuttle program. So in other words, you know, he was someone who probably NASA wouldn't exist in its form that it does today without Jack Parsons. And Parsons became fascinated with the teachings of Crowley. And he, as I said, was also a rocket scientist. And
they were into some weird stuff. I mean, Crowley, you think of him, he was like, as you describe, a grandmaster of the occult.
Yeah.
Basically a devil worshiper who was a worshiper or at least interested in contacting evil spirits. He was into orgies and drugs and a lot of really weird stuff.
Yeah, I mean, he was somebody who sort of really pushed the, you know, pushed the envelope to its limits, so to speak. And, you know, it's one of these situations where Crowley, you know, attracted a lot of people of a like mind. And one of these was Jack Parsons. And Parsons was living out in California and set up Aerojet and was doing a lot of rocket research. But at the same time, you know, he had this other life, which was dominated by the occult. And to give you an example, before every rocket launch, he would actually try and invoke the Greek god Pan and request that the rocket launch was successful. You know, that was his way of doing it. And what a lot of people don't realize is that in the 1940s, because the military was realizing that rocketry was like, hey, you know, this could be the next big thing. So a lot of the work he was doing was of deep interest to the military, and he was actually granted a top secret clearance with the Air Force, Army, and Navy.
Because you got to figure that, do you think that they knew at the time they gave him the clearance that he was into this other weird stuff?
Well, to an extent that they did, but ignored it because they didn't feel it was relevant. But what happened was that in 1946, when after Parsons had actually started to run one of Crowley's organizations out in California, he began sort of getting involved at an even deeper level, you know, with the dabblings, et cetera, and, you know, the portals and doorway openings, et cetera. So basically what happened was that he was getting more and more involved with the military, getting access to more and more government secrets at the same time that his occult world was developing and spreading as well. Now, in 1946, Parsons actually engaged in something similar to what Crowley did, but this was called the Babylon Working, and he essentially was trying to conjure up what was called like an elemental being, like a magical entity, again, from some other realm of existence. And this was sort of seen for some people in the military as the last straw. You know, it's like we've granted a top secret clearance to some guy who's trying to dabble in the occult and, you know, open doorways to other realms, and who knows what he's letting in. Now, at the time, there was sort of no idea, I guess, or feeling that it was anything other than, well, he's a bit eccentric, but he's doing good rocket research. Let's just let him continue and live his weird life as they saw it. But the thing that kind of kicked off the whole Collins elite was that in the late 1940s, after the State of Israel was created, Parsons thought, he actually heard that the Israeli government was looking to develop its own rocket program, and he thought, you know, having his own Aerojet company, wouldn't it be a good idea if I approach the Israelis and see if they're interested in having me work for them? And so what he did, instead of putting a fancy resume together to give them, he actually, quote, borrowed or stole, depending on how you look at it and who you listen to, a number of documents from his workplace at the time where he was contracted, which was the Hughes Aircraft Company, Howard Hughes's company, and stole the documents and was going to give them to the Israelis as a demonstration of the work he could do. And, of course, you had the military and the FBI freaking out that, is this guy actually working as an undercover agent for the Israelis, or has he just been stupidly done something reckless to try and get a job with them? And it turned out to be the latter. He wasn't an agent, you know, working undercover for the Israelis. He just stupidly stole documents and was going to say, here, this is what I'm working on. But what happened from there, and what Richard Duke told me, was that because the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force had all granted him a top secret clearance, all of the intelligence agencies...
Nick, I'm going to ask you to hold on there, because this story really gets into some other interesting names, including Robert Goddard, L. Ron Hubbard, all these guys sort of running around in the same circles, and then that all leads to the creation of this Collins elite. It's just getting good, folks. Stay with us for more of our conversation with Nick Redfern here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Nick Redfern about the creation of something called the Collins elite, an element of our government created to look into these weird entities, devils, demons, call them what you will. The origins of the Collins Elite, as we just learned, can be traced back to the work of Aleister Crowley, who was sort of a grand master of the occult, an infamous devil worshiper, who had some interesting fellow travelers and contemporaries, including L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology. We'll hear more about that in a moment. And Robert Goddard, the father of American rocketry, who just, interestingly enough, had his headquarters in Roswell, New Mexico. As mentioned a couple of minutes ago by Nick Redfern, Aleister Crowley found a way to open a portal to communicate with what he called an elemental. And they gave a name to this creature called Lamb. And our webmaster, Lex, has found the drawing that that Crowley made. He's put it on our Twitter feed, which is available on the Coast homepage. And if you look at this thing, you'll see why people could say, well, heck, that looks like what we would call a gray alien. When we come back, we pick up the story about the Collins Elite and find out just how it got started and whether or not it's still operating today. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. As we are searching the origins of this group called the Collins Elite, we learned from Nick Redfern before the break about this guy, Jack Parsons, who is so famous, I guess, and so revered in aerospace circles and rocketry circles. They've got a crater on the moon that was named for him, and he'd had a home, a mansion, actually, in Southern California. It had these big, elaborate parties where the likes of Robert Heinlein and Ray Bradbury were regular visitors, according to Nick Redfern's book, Final Events. Nick, tell me how L. Ron Hubbard and Robert Goddard fit into this very interesting mix, along with the likes of Aleister Crowley.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, George, Parsons became fascinated with Crowley's work and having an interest in the occult. He began to go down the same path. Essentially, looking at the idea of contacting whatever these otherworldly entities are or were at the time. And he engaged in something known as the Babylon Working in 1946. And basically what happened was that L. Ron Hubbard became friends with Parsons. And, they spent time together hanging out, etc. And Hubbard became fascinated by Parsons' work. They became good friends. And actually, Parsons wrote a letter to Crowley himself, and he wrote, I'm just quoting parts from it here, I deduce that he, i.e. Hubbard, is in direct touch with some higher intelligence. And he continued that he's in complete accord with our own principles. So, in other words, Parsons and Hubbard hit it off, and Parsons began setting up this extensive magical ritual known as the Babylon Working. And the whole goal of this particular project was to try and, invoke some sort of being very, very similar to the one that Crowley had brought into our world decades earlier, this so-called large-headed, bald-headed lamb creature.
And Parsons got one, right?
Yeah, Parsons got one. Basically, what happened was that a couple of weeks later, a woman arrived on the scene named Marjorie Elizabeth Cameron, very beautiful woman, and Parsons deduced or concluded that this was evidence that the rite and ritual had worked, that this, he'd summoned this woman up and she'd suddenly arrived on the scene. And that sort of set the scene for Parsons believing that he actually could achieve what Crowley had achieved 30 years previously. Now, you also mentioned Robert Goddard. What happened with Robert Goddard is that he was a colleague, not necessarily a friend, they were kind of rivals, but he was a colleague of Parsons, and he was also deeply involved in early rocket research and chose to move his base of operations to, of all places, Roswell, New Mexico. In the summer of 1947, we know that Parsons actually met none other than Kenneth Arnold, the man who arguably ushered in the modern era of flying saucers. What happened was that Parsons knew L. Ron Hubbard. L. Ron Hubbard wrote a lot of actually very good and acclaimed science fiction. He wrote a lot of stories, etc., short stories, books. L. Ron Hubbard, being in the realm of science fiction, was acquainted with Ray Palmer. And Ray Palmer was the editor of a number of highly successful sci-fi magazines. And it so happens that Ray Palmer was also the editor publisher and co-author of Kenneth Arnold's book on his encounter called The Coming of the Saucers. And it was through this friend of a friend of a friend that Parsons and Arnold actually got to meet. Now, what was happening when the, as I mentioned before the break, there was this investigation into Parsons' loyalty or not because of the fact that he was working or trying to work with the Israelis on their rocket program. When it was found that he wasn't an espionage agent, but he'd just been reckless with government documents, he was fired from Hughes Aircraft and lost his top secret clearance. But Richard Duke, this elderly group member of the Collins elite I met not long after speaking with Ray Beauchamp, he said that he and a number of the other people who were involved in these early investigations of Parsons' background, the more they dug into it as part of this espionage operation, the more that they learned about his, as he called it, his other life, you know, the occult life. And they became fascinated by it. And even when the operation had come to a halt and it was closed down, you know, as he described it to me, they would get together and meet sometimes after work and discuss, you know, what they'd found out about Parsons. They found him to be like a fascinating guy with an interesting, although as they saw it, weird life. And, you know, they were sort of looking further into what his belief systems. And it was then that they found the crossovers with the whole UFO thing. Richard Duke told me the fact that he knew Arnold was interesting. And being on the inside, they said they'd heard rumors about that the Roswell incident wasn't a weather balloon. They weren't actually briefed back then on what had happened, but they said we all knew it wasn't just a weather balloon. And then when they found that he was associated with Goddard out at Roswell, Richard Duke said it was a case of really just trying to put together a few strands and threads of what possibly seemed to be something interconnected. And according to Richard Duke, the whole situation was sort of pretty fluid and relaxed up until about 1952. It was, as he described it, just people, colleagues, friends getting together and discussing it after work. And then in some point in 52, just after Parsons was killed, he actually blew himself up in his lab. What happened was that somebody said, well, you know, something along the lines of Project Blue Book and the old Project Grudge didn't have much success or aren't having much success in trying to resolve this. Why don't we channel some money to these guys, make them an offer and take them out of their regular intelligence jobs and put them in like a think tank situation where they can research this angle, where they've actually made some intriguing threads of putting names and places together and just see if they can come up with anything. And to start with, it seems like it literally was, you know, they would just pay these guys their regular wage and they would sort of sit in an office in a round table situation, maybe no more than 9 or 10 of them to start with, and just pore over the open source material that was around at the time and just try and evaluate it and to see if it would fit more in this picture of the whole Parsons Crowley angle, if you like.
So they would the Collins elite, that's it, and the name is taken from a town, right?
Yeah, that's a very weird story. I mean, I asked, you know, why is it called the Collins Elite? And I thought it was named after someone, a person. But apparently there's a town in New York, or a little village, called Collins in New York State. And one of the people, apparently, that Richard Duke said was consulted by the group was a Quaker. And he was someone who had a lot of interest and actually knowledge of what the group, the areas that the group was following. And he was sort of consulted along the lines of, you know, we'd like your help, being your patriotic nature, you know, not to mention it, etc. But this particular Quaker, he came from Collins itself. Now, Collins is noted for, it's a very small place, and it's just noted for one particular thing, and that is the fact that at one point there was something like 7 or 8 cheese factories there, and pretty much everybody in the town was involved in the cheesemaking industry. And there was sort of this joke amongst these guys that because he felt special and, you know, he was speaking to these guys from the intelligence community, he was the elite of Collins because he was one of the few people in town who wasn't employed in the cheesemaking industry. And it was kind of a joke, they said, that, you know, an insider joke, that they decided to call themselves the Collins Elite. Now, the joking angle aside, you know, the very fact of calling themselves the elite, With hindsight, it makes me wonder if, you know, they were arrogantly thinking, well, we've got the answer, you know, we are right. And I think maybe that does come into it a little bit, you know, that belief even back then that they were on the right track.
Well, about the same time, 1952, what you're talking about, there was a big overflight of Washington on two consecutive weekends that had everybody sort of up in arms. And in that same period, as you mentioned in the book, there was these friendly space brothers, the early, what you would call the contactees, who were telling some really interesting stories about their encounters with otherworldly beings, George Van Tassel, George Adamski, people like that. Pick up the story from there and how that fits into what the Collins elite was doing.
Okay, yeah, this is an interesting time frame because, as I said, Jack Parsons blew himself up in his lab and basically died in hospital in June 1952 when he was trying to, interestingly enough, conjure up a little being known as a homunculus, which is described as like a little man endowed with magical powers. And only a couple of weeks later, you had the Washington overflights, and this led the Collins elite to think that Parsons, with his dabblings, had actually killed him. Had opened or expanded this portal yet again, that possibly he even was responsible for opening with Kenneth Arnold in 47, but he just taken it to another level. And you're quite right that, you know, you mentioned how the contactee movement began in roughly this same period. Now, the contactees, of course, very controversial area where you have people all across the world, and certainly a lot in America in the period 1950, 51, 52, 53, claiming contact with very human-like aliens, usually described as having heads of long blonde hair, which, you know, today wouldn't raise eyebrows if you saw a guy walking down the street with long blonde hair. Back in 52, you'd probably, you know, you'd turn around and look. You just didn't see it that often, if at all even. And so people were talking about having these meetings with these long-haired aliens that became known as the Space Brothers. The meetings would often occur in remote locations like deserts, forests, places like that. And the contactees wouldn't really know why they were meeting these entities for the first time, but it was almost as if after the first meeting, they felt galvanized and changed to go out and spread the cosmic word, if you like. The Space Brothers seemed to be concerned by our use of nuclear weapons and the proliferation of nuclear weapons and wanted us to live in peace and harmony. And to have the contactees spread that message. Now, some of the contactees actually didn't make their contacts with these so-called aliens via going out into the desert and, you know, meeting these entities in a nuts and bolts craft. What actually happened in some cases was they too, like Crowley and Parsons, used altered states. Now, George Hunt Williamson, one of the early famous contactees, he claimed to have made alien contact on a regular basis via Ouija boards. Now, for the Collins elite, you know, that was a big red flag. They saw Ouija boards as something that whatever you call up and comes through is always deceptive and is negative and demonic. And so when they found that somebody in the early years of the contactee movement was actually claiming to contact aliens via Ouija boards, they saw this as another example of demonic deception. On top of that, George Adamski, who was one of arguably the most famous contactee of all time, his co-author, Desmond Leslie, Desmond Leslie's father, Sir Shane Leslie, was deeply steeped in the world of the occult and actually was a deep adherent of the teachings of Aleister Crowley. So, you know, again, you have people in the early years of the contactee movement involved. And on top of that, George Van Tassel, probably the second most famous contactee next to George Adamski, was employed by Hughes Aircraft, and he was good friends with Howard Hughes. And it happened to be the Howard Hughes Aircraft Company that Jack Parsons worked for.
That's right. Yeah.
So in other words, they're putting all these threads together and seeing, you know, a linkage, if you like, not necessarily understanding what it all meant, but concluding that it certainly meant something.
You mention in the book this lady named Frances Swan. Mm. Why is she important to the story?
Well, again, this is sort of something in the way in which the story develops, something that we see going on from the sort of the early to mid 1950s onwards. Now, Frances Swan basically was someone who claimed alien contact. And the story was that in 1954, this is when she started making contact with alien intelligences, again, in an altered state via automatic writing. Now, automatic writing essentially is when someone claims that an entity, whether a spirit entity, an alien or whatever, channels through them, and they, you know, the person is, in I guess in simple terms, possessed in some respect, and they begin writing down, you know, the information given to them. It's automatic writing. And again, but Francis Swan, like George Hunt Williamson, perceived that the entities that were channeling through her were extraterrestrials. And a number of agencies followed the story of Francis Swan quite closely, not just the Collins League, but the FBI have now declassified their files on Francis Swan, talking about how they visited her, conducted an interview with her, because she was talking again also about how the aliens supposedly wanted us to disarm our nuclear weapons. And bear in mind, this was the whole Cold War Reds under the beds era. You know, they wanted to speak to her because her UFO material was getting into sort of political areas as well. Now, what's kind of weird is that Francis Swan's next-door neighbour was a man named Rear Admiral Herbert Bain Knowles. And it so turns out that a couple of years later, when the NICAP, the old National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, was formed in 1956, that he actually became a board director. And the Collins elite believed that it wasn't coincidence that Francis Swan happened to live next door to Herbert Baines Knowles and had been contacted by these entities. They actually thought that these entities had kind of got their clutches into Francis Swan, and from there she'd attracted the attention of Admiral Knowles, and that when he became part of NICAP, his relationship with Swan had actually influenced his beliefs about aliens in relation to developing NICAP's thoughts on the subject. In other words, you know, it was kind of, if a UFO group's going to be set up and these demonic entities wanted to deceive that group into believing they're alien, what better way to do it than manifest for Knowles' next-door neighbour and have him become convinced by her experience? You know, so it was very, very weird that, you know, that there would be this sort of close proximity between her and him.
Pretty sinister. We got about a minute before the break. I do want to mention one other person that was contacted at some point, and that's Ruth Montgomery, very famous name in psychic media, as a psychic medium. How does she fit in? It's a couple of years later, right?
Yeah, this is right. This is actually the last project, if you like, that Richard Duke told me he was ever involved in. This was sort of the turn of the 1960s. And Ruth Montgomery, I should say, she was like a self-described Christian psychic in the tradition of people like Edgar Cayce. And she was deeply involved in things like automatic writing, channeling, spirit guides, etc. And very also involved in, you know, trying to determine the nature of the human soul, etc., things like that. And Richard Duke said that as time went on throughout the 50s, they began to see that things like automatic writing, channeling, etc., seemed to be playing significant parts in the early years of ufology. And he was tasked with approaching Ruth Montgomery to get her views as to what she believed about this phenomena. And this was sort of one of the surprising things, that they actually supposedly made clandestine approaches to various people with who had, you know, written books or were researching these areas at the time, and just said, you know, can we speak to you off the record? It's part of a government project, etc. And Richard Duke told her a number of things about how, you know, the military was researching out-of-body experiences, ESP.
And then she sort of spilled the beans a little bit on that. We'll pick up the story after this break. Fascinating conversation with Nick Redfern about the Collins elite and this secret study of UFOs as being demonically involved. Stay with us for more on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Nick Redfern about his book, The Final Events, which details the study of, I guess you'd call them, demons by a group called the Collins Elite, which started out looking at UFO cases, UFO reports, got into abduction reports, talked to psychics and contactees, and somewhere along the way decided these are not ETs at all. These are demons. They're evil. They're here for our souls. What was it that convinced them to reach that conclusion? We'll get into that with Nick Redfern right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Right before the break, Nick Redfern was telling us about the Collins group, this outreach to a famous psychic named Ruth Montgomery, who was approached and asked some questions. And then I guess, Nick, she spilled some of the beans in public, right?
Yeah, that's right, George. She was actually a well-respected journalist as well. And, you know, she covered a lot of the political stories of the day as well. Now, one of the things Richard Duke did was actually to bring along to the several meetings I had with him a whole stash of documents, which I was allowed to copy. But he stressed it was all Freedom of Information material, including literally hundreds of pages of Air Force files and Army files on Jack Parsons, but also some FBI documents on Ruth Montgomery. Now, again, this is one of the areas why I think that Richard Duke was legitimate, was because, you know, a lot of people have heard of Ruth Montgomery and read her books. But I think very few people would be aware that it was actually an extensive internal FBI investigation of her. I'd never heard of this at all. And I've scoured around, you know, in books and things like this and have not seen any reference to her having ever, you know, being interviewed or monitored by the FBI, specifically about her occult interests, if you like.
Well, I'd never heard it, but it somehow it doesn't surprise me.
No. But, I mean, I reproduced one of the documents in the book, and when Richard Duke gave them to him, I actually sent them to the FBI to say, you know, have these been declassified through the Freedom of Information Act, and actually got those and more back. You know, I got the complete file. So, in other words, the documents are legitimate, and I think because I'd never seen them before, there's certainly no reference to them in books, it would make sense that an insider would be a person who would know that they existed and had been declassified and wanted to get the story out by specifically passing on, not like MJ-12 documents, but legitimate FOIA materials.
The arrival of abductions, alien, what we'd call alien abductions, the Betty and Barney case and others, is that what sort of turned the tide for the Collins elite? I'm trying to figure out at what point did they decide these are not aliens, these are demons, and what was the proof that convinced them?
Yeah. Well, as I said, up until this point, pretty much, they were looking at it from an occult perspective, that even if these things were alien, they seem to, I guess, work with the occult. If, you know, there could be alien entities that, you know, understood the occult world or the supernatural world and somehow even moved within it. But that sort of changed, you're quite right, over time. And it seems to have been at some point in the 1960s, and it was kind of a combination of things. You had the Betty and Barney Hill case of 1961, which radically changed things from the contactee arena to the whole issue of, you know, abductions by these small entities. And, you know, you have things like, for example, the whole medical experimentation angle, the genetic angle, which was really sort of beginning to take off. And people, albeit at that time, you know, didn't really understand the full details of what was going on. One of the things that the Collins elite were alerted to, and again, I relate the documents, some official documents in the book, was how there seemed to be this pattern developing of people being allegedly kidnapped from their bedrooms at night or from cars like the Hills, driving home late at night. And they were seeing parallels around the world and actually approached the British Ministry of Defence and even said to them, you know, have you, in your UFO files, do you have any reports on record where, for example, people have claimed late night encounters or been, you know, in cases where their car has stalled and then they've had weird dreams, etc. And they did find a number of cases and sent them on to the Defense Intelligence Agency in the US, who in turn forwarded them on to the Collins elite. So they were seeing this, but then further down the line, they came across a very disturbing story of a man named Paul Garrett. Now, Paul Garrett was a guy who was involved in a car accident in the late 1960s in California and had a near-death experience. And he actually wrote to his local newspaper, and I've got the clipping from the newspaper, and he's basically, you know, a letter to the editor talking about this amazing experience he'd had this accident and literally, I guess, died, you know, but he was brought back on the operating table and had one of these classic near-death experiences that people talk about. You know, he said he could see himself leaving his body and floating above himself in the operating room. Next thing he knew, he said, I guess his essence, his soul, however you want to term it, was on this, what looked like a totally alien world, and which he literally interprets to be hell. But he said it wasn't like a hell that he'd ever seen before. It was like a flat landscape, almost how you'd imagine an alien planet might look. And it got kind of disturbing because he said there were just, you know, thousands and thousands of shuffling human beings kind of shuffling around like zombies out of some, you know, a zombie film. And there were these UFO-like craft hovering over them, moving very, very quickly in a fashion that sort of reminded him of, like, worker bees or fast-moving insects. And they seem to be extracting some sort of light, like a ball of light, out of the bodies of the people, which he interpreted that these were sort of almost like machine entities, I guess almost like techno-demons extracting human souls from the recently departed. And this story got back to the Collins elite because somebody apparently read it in the newspaper, and the story got back to the intelligence world and onto the Collins elite. And they uncovered a number of stories like this and eventually came to the conclusion that the whole purpose of why this was demonic was because they came to believe that the human soul possesses some sort of energy or is formed of some form of energy which these entities actually can use as sustenance, in simplistic terms. In other words, they're harvesting human souls.
When I read that chapter, when I read that part of the book, I thought, wow, that rings a bell with me because I had the Lazar story. I had interviewed Bob Lazar, Area 51, and Bob was reluctant to get into this stuff, but he said somewhere along the line he read a report that talked about the harvesting of souls, and I was surprised that you mentioned it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very disturbing area. A number of people who read the book have said, you know, it actually did disturb them. The idea that the Collins elite came to believe that the Earth is essentially like a farm, and that's why the aliens, whatever they are, don't land, because they don't want to help us, but they don't destroy us because they don't want to destroy us. They actually want to maintain the planet and maintain the herd in the same way that the farmer looks after the cattle before he takes them to the slaughterhouse. And their conclusion, based upon addressing things like near-death experiences, consulting with people who had claimed alien abduction encounters where even they felt some of the abductees, their soul had been separated from the bodies, they concluded that there were, in simple terms, soul factories where these entities were literally just feeding upon, you know, millions and millions of departed souls and using us as like an energy source. Kind of like in the scene in the Matrix where Keanu Reeves wakes up from what he thinks is the real world, and only to find, you know, there's millions of people just in endless pods where they're being used as a battery for the machines that now run the world. You know, the real world as we see it is actually like a hologram type thing. And they viewed it in the same way, and essentially seeing these entities as being demonic, but possibly in a sort of complex and strange way, also utilizing highly advanced technologies. Almost like techno demons, as one of the people described.
That's a good term. I mean, it's hard to tell. It would be hard for them to tell. It's hard for us to tell. You've got these, essentially, they're shapeshifters. They take different forms. They're liars. They're deceptive. They, one minute they tell us they're aliens. Maybe they're demons the next. I mean, I guess you'd have to admit that we really don't know for sure what the heck they are.
No, I mean, I think this is a good point. You know, it's like, and if you look at the UFO subjects, or the phenomena, I should say, there's no doubt that it's sort of radically changed over the years. You know, in the 1800s, we had the Phantom Airships, Foo Fighters in the Second World War, the Ghost Rockets in 46, Flying Saucers in 47. Now we have the Black Triangles, you know, and we had the long-haired space aliens and the Greys. So it's like the phenomenon has almost changed as the times have changed. And they sort of astutely realized this, the group, and also concluded that, you know, back in times past, that when people said they saw things like goblins and djinns and things like that from ancient folklore, that that was a manifestation of this same phenomenon, but actually appearing in a guise, if you like, that reflected the belief systems of the people of that day. In other words, to deceive them as well, you know, thousands of years ago.
Well, like Passport to Magonia, Valet's book, where he suggests that maybe it's all the same thing.
Yes, but appearing in a different fashion for the people of that particular era, rather than the people misinterpreting what they were seeing. You know, they actually concluded that they were seeing goblins or djinns. You know, they weren't misinterpreting aliens, if you like. So.
You said earlier in the interview that you actually ended up talking to a couple of different members of the Collins elite.
Yes.
And you're convinced it is real. Is it still operating?
Well, you know, that's the interesting question. I mean, to give you some background so people will know, I was able to verify that the people I interviewed had held positions in the intelligence community. There's no doubt about that. you know, the big question is, were they relating something that because somebody wanted to get the story out, or was there another agenda? And, you know, hand on heart, you know, I try and be objective. I truthfully cannot say. But what I can say for certain is that there's no doubt in my mind the group existed and it came to these conclusions. Now, today, it seems to be the case that the group, in many respects, may not still exist in terms of it doing active work. What I was told was that, for the most part, the projects that have been going on for decades are pretty much in a closed status because they believe that they've now proven, you know, abductions are being done as part of this soul-reaping project. The idea is that sort of abductions are, I guess, the way in which, you know, they undertake experimentation to try and literally harvest the soul, possibly while we're still alive, and maybe abductions are connected with this. But they believe they've now proven, to their satisfaction at least, of what's going on, and so there's no more point now in investigating it, and they feel that the only angle now is how we tell the general, or how they tell the general public, or even if they can tell the general public what they believe is happening without society collapsing as a result. And they had some very ominous ideas about how the future should progress. Now, this gets into an extremely controversial area. They concluded that these entities, part of their ability to interact with us is based upon our willingness to believe they exist. Now, that sort of sounds strange. It's almost as if, you know, belief in them actually strengthens their ability to act in our world, in our realm, if you like. And the group concluded that strong religious denial, or you know, having a totally anti-approach to them, but with a religious background, could thwart them and keep them at bay. And so their viewpoint is, how do we do that? Well, we have to change the mindset of the population to a deep fundamentalist Christian perspective where everybody is in fear of the Christian God, but have being so fearful of having such a deep belief system would prevent these entities from interacting with us and winning the day, so to speak. And so one of the things that was looked at was if there was some sort of terror attack in the US and martial law was put into place, would it allow for some, or could it allow for some sort of radical religion-dominated government to come into place, which would do away with pretty much, you know, freedom of speech and human rights, etc., and the country become a surveillance state, essentially. But they felt it was worth it if, by changing the mindset of the population to, as I said, this deep fundamentalist angle, it actually protected their souls in the process. That was literally the sort of the skewed thinking that they were following. Now, whether or not that's actually true, you know, I was told it was more like a roundtable discussion thing with PowerPoint presentations and, you know, talking about whether it was actually feasible, not the fact that it was actually on the cards and was being planned, but the idea of, hey, you know, if we can rewire the population and they believe this is all going on, it'll actually save their souls. And the loss of freedom, et cetera, was seen as a viable alternative to everybody going to hell in their...
Well, it would seem then that you writing about it, that this book coming out that sort of spills the beans,
well, yeah,
lends credence to it, doesn't it? Strengthen the bad guy's hand.
Well, well, in one sense, but I mean, the thing is that the people who told me, one guy, Robert Manners, who related this to me, he was actually someone who was dead set against this whole angle of trying to bring religion more into government and the military, and so I suspect the ones who actually want, within the group, who want this to happen, probably aren't happy that he spilled the beans. So in other words, it seems like there's almost a battle going on within the intelligence world about who should be told, if people should be told, and how it should be handled in terms of the present day and the future. So I think, you know, there are people who... Robert Manners certainly was not happy with even the very fact that just at a roundtable PowerPoint presentation that this whole scenario of, you know, almost trying to generate or allow to happen like a terrorist attack where the worst parts of the Patriot Act would be invoked and, you know, the country would be in lockdown situation, and then it would be a case of indoctrinating the public with these belief systems. Although he said, I'm a Christian. He said, not the Christianity he was taught. He said that he felt that deceiving the public to try and hold off another deception by these entities is not the way to go. He felt there should have been maybe briefings or information given to the public and along the lines of, hey, this is our theory, this is what we think is happening, and we want people to know. You know, whether or not that would work or whether it should even be done. You know, I think all those sort of things were discussed.
You know, Nick, we go to these UFO conferences. You go to more of them than I do, but you hear these stories occasionally of abductees who invoke the name of Christ or some biblical passage as a way to ward off the purported aliens that are coming after them. And I never gave them too much credence. I didn't seem to me like aliens would worry about Christian dogma or beliefs. Now, I guess in this context, maybe that makes sense. Do you give any credence to that?
Well,
technique?
You know, there's several things I can say about that. One of the people I interviewed for the book was a man named Joe Jordan. Joe's a safety specialist at NASA's Kennedy Space Center, and he developed an interest in UFOs, and particularly with the whole abduction angle. Now, one of the things that Joe now has a very good website where he collects reports and publishes them of people who've claimed alien abduction experiences and who've been able to stop them by calling out the name of Jesus, you know, and saying basically stop or go away. I think we could look at this in two ways. You know, certainly from the Collins elite's perspective, this would be right in line with what they're saying. Now, I think that if these are some sort of entity that interacts with us and, you know, they understand and perhaps can even get inside our minds, if we put up a barrier to them, maybe that actually prevents them. So, you know, calling out the name of Jesus for somebody who is a deep Christian would possibly work because it would put up a barrier where the person actually believes, you know, Jesus will stop this. And if these things are trying to get into our minds, then that may work. In the same way, somebody else calling up, you know, Buddha or whatever, you know, that may work because they're using the full force of their mind and their belief system to cast out these entities that are trying to get in their mind. So I think that I think we could look at it from that perspective as well, that any sort of powerful thought of just stop, get out, could work if these things exist in like an altered state where they don't necessarily interact with us always physically, but possibly on a mind-to-mind basis, just that jolt of us saying, be gone, you know, and invoking any sort of entity or deity, if you like, might actually work. It doesn't necessarily mean it's that deity actually achieving it. It could be just the force of the person's sheer will and their belief system that causes the abduction or whatever to come to an end, I think.
Well, you know, whatever works in a situation like that. Still plenty to talk about. I'm curious whether there's a Nazi angle on any of this. The Nazis, of course, very interested in the occult, and I wonder if and of course they brought a lot of the rocket knowledge, whether they crossed paths with Goddard or any of those other folks. And a lot more to come, and we'll be opening up the phone lines for your questions for Nick Redfern and about his new book, Final Events. Stay